Chapter 5, March 1942 to June 1942. Never before. Here's how Alvin came to have it in for Sandy. Before leaving him alone on the morning of his first Monday back, my mother had made Alvin promise to use his crutches to get around on until one of us was home to fetch for him. But Alvin so despised being on crutches that he refused, even by himself, to submit to the stability they provided. At night, when we were in our beds and the lights were out, Alvin would get me laughing by explaining why crutching wasn't so simple as my mother thought. "You go to the bathroom," Alvin said, "and they're always falling. They're always clattering. They're always making a fucking noise. You go to the bathroom, you've got these crutches, you try to get your cock, and you can't get your cock because your crutches are in the way. You gotta get rid of the crutches. Then, you're standing on one leg. That's not so good. You lean one way or another, you splatter all over the place. Your father tells me to sit down to piss. You know what I say? I'll sit when you do, Herman. Fucking crutches, standing on one leg, taking your dick out, Jesus. Pissing is hard enough to do as it is." I'm laughing uncontrollably now. Not only because the story is especially funny as he half whispers it in the darkened room, but because never before has a man revealed himself to me this way, using the prohibited word so freely and openly cracking toilet jokes. "Come on," Alvin says. "Own up to it, kiddo. Pissing's not something that's as easy as it looks." So it happened that on that first Monday morning alone, when the amputation was still a limitless loss that he assumed would impede and torment him forever, he took the fall that no one in the family knew about other than me. He was standing braced against the kitchen sink, where, without the aid of his crutches, he'd gone for a glass of water. When he turned to start back to the bedroom, he forgot, for all possible reasons, that he had just the one leg and, instead of hopping, did what everyone else did in our house. Began to walk, and of course toppled over. The pain shooting up from the butt end of his stump was worse than the pain in the missing segment of his leg. Pain, Alvin explained to me, after I first watched him succumb to a siege in the bed beside me, that grabs you and won't let you go though no limb is left to cause it. "There's pain where you are," Alvin said when the time had come to reassure me with some kind of comical remark, "and there's pain where you ain't." I wonder who thought that up. The English hospital gave the amputees morphine to control the pain. "You're always calling for it," Alvin told me, "and whenever you do, they give it to you. You push a button for the nurse, and when she gets to you, you tell her, morphine, morphine, and you're pretty much out of it." "How much did it hurt in the hospital?" I asked him. "It was no fun, kiddo." "Was that the worst pain you ever had?" "Worst pain I ever had," he replied, "was when my father closed the door of the car on my finger when I was 6 years old." He laughed, and so I laughed. "My father said, when he saw me crying like hell, this little stinker about that high, my father said, 'Stop crying! That doesn't do any good.'" Quietly laughing again, Alvin said, "And that was probably worse than the pain. My last memory of him, too. Later that day, he keeled over and died." Writhing on the kitchen linoleum, Alvin had no one to call for help, let alone for a shot of morphine. Everybody was off at either school or at work, and so, in time it was necessary, to grope his way across the kitchen and the foyer to his bed. But just as he was positioning himself to push up from the floor, he spotted Sandy's art portfolio. Sandy still used the portfolio to preserve his large pencil and charcoal drawings between tracing paper and to carry them with him when he had to take the drawing somewhere to show. It was too large to store in the sun parlor, and so he left it behind in our room. Mere curiosity impelled Alvin to fish the portfolio out a ways from beneath the bed, but because he was unable right off to determine its purpose, and because all he really wanted was to be back under the covers, he was ready to forget about it when he noticed the ribbon that held the two halves together. Existence was worthless, living was unendurable. He still throbbed with pain from the mindless accident at the kitchen sink, and so for no reason other than he felt himself powerless to carry off a physical task any more formidable, he fiddled with the ribbons until he undid the bow. What he found inside were the three portraits of Charles A. Lindbergh as an aviator that Sandy had told my parents he destroyed 2 years back, as well as those he'd drawn at the behest of Aunt Evelyn once Lindbergh became president. I'd only seen the new ones myself when Aunt Evelyn took me along to New Brunswick to hear Sandy give his Just Folks recruitment speech in the synagogue basement. This shows President Lindbergh signing into law the Universal Conscription Act, designed to keep America at peace by teaching our youth the skills necessary to protect and defend the nation. This one shows the president at a draftsman's drawing board, adding his aeronautical suggestions to the design for the nation's newest fighter bomber. Here, I show President Lindbergh relaxing at the White House with the family dog. Each of the new Lindbergh portraits, exhibited as a prelude to Sandy's New Brunswick talk, Alvin examined on the bedroom floor. Then, despite the destructive urge aroused by his registering the skill so meticulously expended on these beautiful likenesses, he placed them between the leaves of tracing paper and shoved the portfolio back under the bed. Once Alvin was out and around in the neighborhood, he hadn't to rely only on Sandy's Lindbergh drawings to realize that, while he'd been making raids on ammo depots in France, Roosevelt's Republican successor had come to be, if not entirely trusted by the Jews, accepted as tolerable for the time being, even among those of our neighbors who had started out hating him as passionately as my father did. Walter Winchell persisted in attacking the president on his Sunday night radio show, and everybody on the block devotedly tuned him in to give credence, while they listened, to his alarming interpretations of the president's policies. But as nothing that they had feared had come to pass since the inauguration, our neighbors slowly began putting more faith in Rabbi Bengelsdorf's optimistic assurances than in Winchell's dire prophecies. And not just the neighbors, but Jewish leaders all over the country began openly to acknowledge that Newark's Lionel Bengelsdorf, far from having betrayed them by endorsing Lindy in the 1940 election, had been prescient enough to see where the nation was headed, and that his elevation to the directorship of the Office of American Absorption and the administration's foremost advisor on Jewish affairs was the direct result of his having cleverly gained Lindbergh's confidence as an early supporter. If the president's anti-Semitism had somehow been neutralized, or more remarkably eradicated, Jews were willing to attribute the miracle to the influence of the venerable rabbi who was soon to become another miracle, an uncle by marriage to Sandy and me. One day, early in March, I wandered over, uninvited, to the dead-end street backing onto the school playground where Alvin had begun shooting craps and playing stud poker if the afternoon was warm enough and if it wasn't raining. He was rarely in the house anymore when I got home after school, and though generally he made it back by 5:30 for dinner, after dessert he'd head out to the hot dog hangout a block from my house to meet up with his old high school friends, a few of whom used to pump gas at the Esso station owned by Simkowitz and had been fired, along with him, for stealing from the boss. I'd be asleep by the time he got in for the night, and only when he removed his leg and began hopping to and from the bathroom did I open my eyes and mumble his name before falling back to sleep. Some 7 weeks after he moved into the bed beside mine, I ceased to be indispensable and abruptly found myself bereft of the mesmeric surrogate he'd been for Sandy, vanished now from my side into the stardom masterminded for him by Aunt Evelyn. The maimed and suffering American pariah, who had come to loom larger for me than any man I'd ever known, including my father, whose passionate struggles had become my own, whose future I fretted over when I should have been listening to the teacher in class, had begun to buddy up with the same good-for-nothings who helped turn him into a petty thief at 16. What he appeared to have lost in combat, along with his leg, was every decent habit inculcated in him when he was living as my parents' ward. Nor did he display any interest in the fight against fascism, which, 2 years earlier, no one could restrain him from joining. In fact, why he went scooting out of the house on his artificial leg every night was, at the beginning anyway, largely to avoid having to sit in the living room while my father read the war news aloud from the paper. There was no campaign against the Axis powers that my father didn't agonize about, particularly when things went badly for the Soviet Union and Great Britain, and it was clear how urgently they needed the U.S. arms embargoed by Lindbergh and the Republican Congress. By this time, my father could deploy the terminology of a war strategist quite proficiently, when he expatiated on the need for the British, Australians, and Dutch to prevent the Japanese, who, in sweeping across Southeast Asia, exhibited all the righteous cruelty of the racially superior, from proceeding westward into India and southward into New Zealand and on to Australia. In the early months of 1942, the Pacific War news that he read to us was uniformly bad. There was the successful Japanese drive into Burma, the Japanese capture of Malaya, the Japanese bombing of New Guinea, and, after devastating attacks from the sea and air and the capturing of tens of thousands of British and Dutch troops on the ground, the fall of Singapore, Borneo, Sumatra, and Java. But it was the progress of the Russian campaign that upset my father most. The year before, when the Germans appeared to be on the verge of overrunning every major city in the eastern half of the Soviet Union, including Kiev, from whose environs my maternal grandparents had emigrated to America in the 1890s, the names of even lesser Russian cities, like Petrozavodsk, Novgorod, Dnipropetrovsk, and Taganrog, had become as familiar to me as the capitals of the 48 states. In the winter of 1941-42, the Russians had staged the impossible counterattacks that broke the sieges of Leningrad, Moscow, and Stalingrad. But by March, the Germans had regrouped from their winter catastrophe and, as demonstrated by the troop movements mapped out in the Newark News, were reinforcing for a spring offensive to conquer the Caucasus. My father explained that what made the prospect of a Russian collapse so awful was that it would represent to the world the invincibility of the German war machine. The vast natural resources of the Soviet Union would fall into German hands and the Russian people forced to serve the Third Reich. Worst of all, for us, was that with Germany's eastward advance, millions and millions of Russian Jews would come under the control of an occupying army equipped in every way to implement Hitler's messianic program to deliver humanity from the clutches of the Jews. According to my father, the brutal triumph of anti-democratic militarism was imminent just about everywhere. The massacre of Russian Jewry, including members of my mother's extended family, was all but at hand, and Alvin didn't care one bit. No longer was he burdened by concern for anyone suffering other than his own. I found Alvin down on the good knee of the real leg, dice in hand, and the pile of bills beside him secured by a jagged chunk of cement. With the prosthetic leg jutting straight out in front of him, he looked like a squatting Russian dancing one of those crazy Slavic jigs. There were six other gamblers tightly encircling him, three still in the game, clutching what was left of their dough, two who were broke and just standing around, whom I vaguely recognized as ex-Weequake washouts now in their 20s, and the long-legged guy hovering over him, Alvin's partner, as it turned out, Shushy Margulis, a skinny zoot suiter with a sinewy build and a gliding gait, the hanger-on from Alvin's gas station days whom my father most despised. Shushy was known to us kids as the Pinball King because a racketeer uncle whom he boasted about was the Pinball King, and the king as well of illegal slots down in Philadelphia where he reigned, and also because of the hours he spent racking up scores by banging away at the pinball machines in the neighborhood candy stores, shoving the machine, cursing it, violently shaking it from side to side until play was terminated either by the colored lights flashing tilt or by the store owner chasing him out. Shushy was the famous comedian who entertained his admirers by gleefully tossing lit matches into the mouth of the big green mailbox across from the high school, and who had once eaten a live praying mantis on a bet, and who, during his short-lived academic career, liked to hand the crowd a laugh outside the hot dog hangout by limping across Chancellor Avenue with one hand raised to stop the oncoming traffic, limping badly, tragically, though nothing was wrong with him. By this time, he was already into his 30s and still living with his seamstress mother in one of the little flats at the top of a 2.5-family house next door to the synagogue on Wainwright Street. It was to Shushy's mother, known sympathetically to one and all as poor Mrs. Margulis, that my mother had taken Alvin's pants to have the zippers sewn in. Poor Mrs. Margulis, not merely because she survived as a widow by doing piecework at slave wages for a down-neck dress manufacturer, but because her sharpie son seemed never to have held a job, other than as a runner for the bookie who worked out of the pool room around the corner from their house and just down the street from the Catholic orphanage on Lyons Avenue. The orphanage stood within the fenced-off grounds of St. Peter's, the parish church that oddly monopolized some three square blocks at the very heart of our unredeemable neighborhood. The church itself was topped by a tall bell tower and an even taller steeple that was capped by a cross that rose divinely above the telephone wires. Locally, there was no building that high to be seen until you proceeded nearly a mile down the Lyons Avenue hill to my birthplace, the Beth Israel Hospital, where every boy I knew had been born as well, and, at the age of 8 days, ritually circumcised in the hospital sanctuary. Flanking the bell tower of the church were two smaller steeples that I never cared to examine because the faces of Christian saints were said to be carved into the stone, and the church's high, narrow stained glass windows told a story that I didn't want to know. Near the church was a small rectory. Like most everything else situated within the black iron palings of this alien world, it had been built during the latter part of the previous century, several decades before the first of our houses went up, and the western edge of the Wequake neighborhood took shape as Newark's Jewish frontier. Behind the church was the grammar school serving the orphans. There were about 100 of them, and a smaller number of local Catholic kids. The school and the orphanage were run by an order of nuns. German nuns, I remember being told. Jewish children, raised even in tolerant households like mine, would generally cross the street on the rare occasions we saw them swishing our way in their witchy attire, and family lore had it that when my brother, as a small child sitting alone on our front stoop one afternoon, spotted a pair of them approaching from Chancellor Avenue, he had called excitedly to my mother, "Look, Ma! The nuts!" A convent stood next to the orphan's residence. Both were simple red brick buildings, and at the end of a summer's day, you'd sometimes catch a glimpse of the orphans. White children, girls and boys, aged from about 6 to 14, sitting outdoors on the fire escape. I have no memory of seeing the orphans in a group anywhere else, certainly not running freely about the streets the way we did. A swarm of them would have discomforted me no less than did the unsettling appearance of the nuns, primarily because they were orphaned, but also because they were said to be both neglected and indigent. Back of the residence hall, and unlike anything to be seen in our neighborhood, or anywhere else in an industrial city of close to 500,000, was a truck farm of the kind that made New Jersey the Garden State, back when compact family vegetable farms able to turn a small profit dotted the undeveloped rural reaches of the state. The food grown and harvested at St. Peter's went to feed the orphans, the dozen or so nuns, the old Monsignor in charge, and the younger priest who was his assistant. With the help of the orphans, the land was worked by a resident German farmer called Timmis. Unless I'm remembering incorrectly, and that was the name of St. Peter's Monsignor, who had been running the place for years. At our public elementary school less than a mile away, it was rumored that the nuns, who instructed the orphans in class, routinely smacked the stupidest of them across the hands with wooden rulers, and that when a boy's offense was so gross as to be intolerable, the Monsignor's assistant was called in to beat him across the buttocks with the same whip the farmer used on the sway-backed pair of lumbering workhorses that pulled the plow for the spring planting. These horses we all knew and recognized because from time to time they'd wander together across the farm to the little wooded meadow at the southern boundary of St. Peter's domain and stick their heads inquisitively out above the gate that backed onto Goldsmith Avenue, where the crap game might come upon was taking place. There was a chain-link fence about 7 feet high at the edge of the playground on the near side of Goldsmith Avenue, and a wire fence set in posts at the edge of the truck farm on the far side. And since no houses had as yet gone up anywhere nearby, and there was never much foot or automobile traffic to speak of, an almost sylvan seclusion was conveniently provided there for the neighborhood's tiny handful of losers to pursue their pleasures out of harm's way. The closest I'd ever come to one of these sinister conclaves before was when, during some playground game, I'd had to chase a ball that had rolled to where they all huddled together just beyond the fence, uttering imprecations at one another and saving their sweet talk for the dice. Now, I was no righteous little foe of crap shooting, and I had begged Alvin to teach me how to play one afternoon when he was still on crutches, and my mother had instructed me to accompany him to his dentist appointment and do things like drop his fare into the fare box and hold his crutches for him while he helped onto the street from the bus's back door. That night, when everyone else had gone to sleep and we'd switched off the table lamp on the stand between our beds, he watched with a smile as, by the beam of my flashlight, I whispered, "Dice, be nice," and soundlessly rolled 3 consecutive 7s across my sheets. Yet as I watched him now in the clutches of his inferiors, and remembered all that my family had sacrificed to prevent him from turning himself into a replica of Shushy, every obscenity I'd learned as his roommate flooded foully into my mind. I cursed him in behalf of my father, my mother, and especially my ostracized brother. Was it for this that all of us had agreed to endure Alvin's objectionable behavior toward Sandy? Was it for this that he'd run off to fight in the war? I thought, take your fucking metal, gimp, and shove it. If only he would learn his lesson by losing every last penny of his disability pension. But in fact, he couldn't stop himself from winning, any more than he could stop himself from abandoning the desire to ever again be anyone's hero. And having already raked in a big wad of bills, he held the dice to my lips, and in a gravelly voice with which he intended to be funny for his friends, he instructed me. "Blow on them, baby." I blew, he rolled, and won yet again. 6 and 1, making what? He asked. 7, I obediently answered, the hard way. Shushy reached down to muss my hair and began calling me Alvin's mascot, as though mascot could encompass what I'd resolved to be for Alvin since he'd come home, as though a word so hollow and childish could account for why Alvin's King George medal was pinned to my undershirt. Shushy was dressed in a chocolate-colored, double-breasted gabardine suit with peg trousers and wide padded shoulders and flamboyant lapels, his favorite get-up whenever he went bopping around the neighborhood, snapping his fingers and, in my mother's words, wasting his life. While back in their tiny attic flat, his mother hemmed 100 dresses a day to meet the family's bills. When he missed his point, Alvin drew all his winnings together and ostentatiously stuffed the bundle into his pocket, the man who broke the bank behind the high school. Then, by grasping the chain-link fence, he pulled himself to his feet. I knew, and not just from observing the tortured way he began limping about to get himself going, that a big boil had erupted on his stump the night before, and that he wasn't in the best of shape that day. But he refused any longer to be seen on crutches by anyone outside the family. And before going off to team up with sleazy Shushy and spend another day blatantly repudiating all the ideals that had made him a cripple, he harnessed the stump into the prosthesis, however much it hurt. "Goddamn leg maker," was all he said by way of complaint as he came up to put his hand on my shoulder. "Can I go home now?" I whispered. "Sure, why not?" And then he took 2 $10 bills out of his pocket, nearly half my father's weekly paycheck, and flattened them against the palm of my hand. Never before had money seemed like something alive. Instead of heading back across the playground, I took a slightly longer route home, proceeding down the Goldsmith Avenue hill to Hobson Street so that I could look up close at the orphanage horses. I had never dared to reach over and touch them. And before that day, I'd never spoken to them the way other kids did, satirically calling these mud-spattered beasts drooling gooey saliva, Omaha and Whirlaway, which were the names of 2 of the greatest Kentucky Derby winners of our day. I stopped a safe distance back from where the darkly gleaming high-relief eyes peered out above the orphanage fence, impassively monitoring through their long lashes the no-man's land separating the stronghold of St. Peter's from the neighborhood of Jews beyond the pale. The chain was unlooped and hanging down off the gate. I had only to yank up on the latch and swing the gate open, and the horses would be free to gallop away. The temptation was enormous, as was the spite. "Fucking Lindbergh," I said to the horses. "Nazi fucking bastard Lindbergh." And then, for fear that if I did fling open the gate, instead of the horses running free, they'd use their big teeth to drag me into the orphanage, I darted down the street and, turning on Hobson, raced past the block-long row of 4 family houses and out to the corner of Chancellor Avenue, where housewives I recognized were in and out of the grocery and the bakery and the butcher shop, and older boys whose names I knew were riding their bikes, and the tailor's son was carrying over either shoulder a load of newly pressed clothes for delivery, and where Italian singing issued onto the street through the shoemaker's doorway. His radio tuned, as always, to WEVD, the EVD to honor the persecuted socialist hero, Eugene V. Debs, and where I was safe from Alvin, Shushy, the horses, the orphans, the priests, the nuns, and the parochial school whip. When I turned back up the hill toward home, a man neatly dressed in a business suit fell in step beside me. It was still too early for the local workingmen to be getting home for dinner, and so I knew right off to be suspicious. "Master Philip?" he inquired with a broad smile. "You ever listen to Gangbusters on the radio, Master Philip? About J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI?" "Yes." "Well, I work for Mr. Hoover. He's my boss. I'm an agent from the FBI. Here," he said, and he removed a billfold from an inside coat pocket and flipped it open to show me his badge. "If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to ask you a few little questions." "I don't mind, but I'm on my way home. I have to get home." Immediately, I thought about the two $10 bills. If he searched me, if he had a warrant to search me, wasn't he going to find all that money and assume it was stolen? Wouldn't anybody? And until 10 minutes earlier, for an entire lifetime, I'd been walking around with my pockets empty, out on the street without a penny to my name. My allowance of 5 cents a week, I saved in a jelly jar, with a slit Sandy chiseled into the lid with the can opener blade of his Boy Scout knife. Now, I was walking around like a bank robber.
"Don't be frightened. Calm down, Master Philip. You've heard Gangbusters. We're on your side. We protect you. I just want to ask a few questions about your cousin Alvin. How's he doing?"
"He's fine."
"How's his leg coming along?"
"Good."
"He's able to walk okay?"
"Yes."
"Wasn't that him I saw over there where you just came from? Wasn't that Alvin behind the playground?
Out on the sidewalk. Wasn't that Alvin with Shushy Margulis?"
I didn't reply, and so he said, "It's okay if they're shooting craps. That's no crime. That's just part of being a big man. Alvin must have shot craps a lot in the army hospital up in Montreal." When I still wouldn't speak, he asked, "What were the fellows talking about?"
"Nothing."
"All afternoon they were out there and they're talking about nothing?"
"They were just saying how much they were losing."
"Nothing else? Nothing about the president?"
"You know who the president is, don't you?
Charles A. Lindbergh."
"Nothing about President Lindbergh, Master Philip?"
"Not that I heard," I answered truthfully.
But might he not have overheard me saying what I'd said to the horses? Impossible. And yet by now I was sure that he knew every move I made since Alvin came home from the war and gave me his medal. It was indisputable that he knew that I was wearing the medal. Why else was he looking me over from head to toe?
"Did they talk about Canada?" he asked. "About going to Canada?"
"No, sir."
"Call me Don, why don't you? And I'll call you Phil. You know what a fascist is, don't you, Phil?"
"I think so."
"Did they call anybody a fascist that you remember?"
"No."
"Don't rush yourself. Don't rush to answer. Take all the time you need. Try hard to remember. It's important. Did they call anybody a fascist? Did they say anything about Hitler?" "You know who Hitler is. Everybody does."
"He's a bad man, isn't he?"
"Yes," I said.
"He's against the Jews, isn't he?"
"Yes."
"Who else is against the Jews?"
"The Bund."
"Anyone else?" he asked.
I knew enough not to mention Henry Ford, America First, the Southern Democrats, or the isolationist Republicans, let alone Lindbergh. Over the past few years, the list I heard at home of prominent Americans who hated Jews was far longer than that. And then there were the ordinary Americans, tens of thousands of them, maybe millions of them, like the beer drinkers we didn't want to live beside in Union, and the owner of the hotel in Washington, and the mustached diner who'd insulted us in the cafeteria near Union Station. Don't talk, I told myself, as though a protected boy of 9 were mixed up with criminals and had something to hide. But I must already have begun to think of myself as a little criminal because I was a Jew.
"And who else?" he repeated.
"Mr. Hoover wants to know who else. Come clean, Phil."
"I am," I insisted.
"How's your Aunt Evelyn doing?"
"She's fine."
"She's getting married, isn't that right? That she's getting married, you can at least answer that."
"Yes."
"And you know who she's marrying?"
"Yes."
"You're a smart boy. I think you know more. A lot more." but you're too smart to tell me, aren't you? She's marrying Rabbi Bengelsdorf, I said. He's head of the OAA. I sang that, made him laugh. Okay, he told me. You're going home. Go home and eat your matzahs. Isn't that what makes you so smart, eating the matzahs? We were now at the corner of Chancellor and Summit, and I could see the stoop of our house down at the end of the block. Bye, I cried, and didn't wait for the light to change, but ran for home before I fell into his trap, if I hadn't fallen into it already. There were three police cars parked on the street in front of our house. Our alleyway was blocked off by an ambulance, and a couple of cops stood on the stoop talking together while another was posted beside the back door. The women on the block, most of them still in their aprons, were on their front stoops trying to figure out what was going on. And all the kids were huddled on the sidewalk across the street from our house, peering out at the cops and the ambulance from between the row of parked cars. Never before could I remember them silently gathered together like that, looking so apprehensive. Our downstairs neighbor was dead. Mr. Wishnow had committed suicide. That was why everything I could never have expected to see was now right outside the door of our house. Weighing barely 80 pounds, he had been able to strangulate himself by stringing the living room curtain cords over the wooden rod in the back foyer coat closet, then looping them around his neck and falling forward off the edge of the kitchen chair where he seated himself inside the closet. When Selden, home from school, went to put his coat away, he found his father in his pajamas, hanging face down on the closet floor amid the family's rubbers and galoshes. My first thought on learning the news was that I no longer had to be fearful of hearing a coughing fit emanating from the dying man in the first floor flat whenever I was alone in the cellar, or of hearing him in my bed on the floor above when I was trying to fall asleep. But then I realized that the ghost of Mr. Wishnow would now join the circle of ghosts already inhabiting the cellar, and that just because I was relieved he was dead, he would go out of his way to haunt me for the rest of my life. Since I didn't know what else to do, I had first kneeled at the side of the parked cars, hiding there with the other kids. None of them had a conception, any larger than my own, of the cataclysm that had befallen the Wishnows, but it was from their whisperings that I pieced together how Mr. Wishnow had died and how he'd been found, and learned that Selden and his mother were inside with one of the policemen and the medics, and with the corpse. The corpse was what the kids were all waiting to see. I waited with them rather than wind up entering the back hallway just as they were carrying Mr. Wishnow down the stairs. Nor did I want to get home and have to sit there alone until my mother, my father, or Sandy appeared. As for Alvin, I wanted never to see him again or to be questioned about him by anyone. The woman who emerged from the house accompanying the medics wasn't Mrs. Wishnow, but my mother. I couldn't understand why she was home from work until it dawned on me that the dead father they were carrying away was my own. Yes, of course. My father had committed suicide. He couldn't take any more of Lindbergh and what Lindbergh was letting the Nazis do to the Jews of Russia, and what Lindbergh had done to our family right here, and so it was he who had hanged himself in our closet. I didn't have hundreds of memories of him then. I had just one, and it did not seem to me at all important enough to be the memory I ought to be having. Alvin's last memory of his father was of him closing the car door on his little boy's finger. Mine of my father was of him greeting the stump of a man who begged every day outside his office building. "How you doing, little Robert?" my father said, and the stump of a man replied, "How you, Herman?" It was here that I edged myself between the closely parked cars and darted out across the street. When I saw the sheet covering my father's body and face couldn't possibly allow him to breathe, I began to wail. Don't, darling," my mother said. "There's nothing to be frightened of." She put her arms around my head, held me to her, and repeated, "There's nothing to be frightened of. He was sick, and he was suffering, and he died. Now he's not suffering anymore." "He was in the closet," I said. "No, he wasn't. He was in his bed. He died in his bed. He was very, very sick. You knew that. That was why he coughed all the time." By now, the ambulance doors were swung open to receive the stretcher. The medics carefully maneuvered it inside and pulled the door shut behind them. My mother stood next to me on the street, holding my hand in hers and, to my amazement, looking perfectly composed. Only when I made a move to break away from her and run after the ambulance, only when I cried, "He can't breathe," did she finally realize what was torturing me. "It's Mr. Wishnow. It's Mr. Wishnow who is dead." She shook me, gently shook me back and forth to bring me to my senses. "It's Selden's father, dear. He died from his illness this afternoon." I couldn't tell if she was lying to keep me from becoming more hysterical or if she was telling the wonderful truth. "Selden found him in the closet?" "No, I told you, no. Selden found his father in his bed. Selden's mother wasn't home, so he called the police. I came because Mrs. Wishnow called me at the store and asked me to help her. Do you understand? Daddy's at work. Daddy's working." "Oh, what on earth have you been thinking? Daddy will be home for dinner very soon. So will Sandy. There's nothing to be afraid of. Everybody will be home. Everybody is coming home. We'll have our dinner," she said reassuringly. "And everything is going to be fine." But nothing was fine. The FBI agent who grilled me about Alvin on Chancellor Avenue had earlier stopped by Haynes' dress department to question my mother, then by the Metropolitan Newark office to question my father, and, just after Sandy left Aunt Evelyn's office for home, he had boarded my brother's bus and, from the seat alongside him, conducted yet another interrogation. Alvin wasn't at dinner to hear about any of this. Just as we were sitting down to eat, he'd phoned and told my mother not to save anything for him. It seemed that every time he'd made a killing at poker or craps, Alvin took Shushi downtown with him to the Hickory Grill for a charcoal broiled steak dinner. "Alvin's partner in crime," my father called Shushi. What he called Alvin that evening was ungrateful, stupid, reckless, ignorant, and incorrigible. "And bitter," said my mother sadly. "So bitter because of his leg." "Well, I'm sick and tired of his leg," said my father. "He went to war. Who sent him? I didn't. You didn't. Abe Steinheim didn't. Abe Steinheim wanted to send him to college. He went to war on his own, and he's lucky he wasn't killed. He's lucky it was just his leg." "This is it, Bess. I've had it with that boy. The FBI questions my children. Bad enough they harass you and me, and in my office, mind you, in front of the boss." "No," he told her. "This has to stop, and stop now. This is a home. We are a family. He has dinner downtown with Shushi. Let him go live with Shushi." "If only he would go to school," my mother said. "If only he would take a job." "He has a job," my father replied. "Bum." After we finished eating, my mother put a meal together for Selden and Mrs. Wishnow, and my father helped her carry the plates downstairs while Sandy and I were left with the dinner dishes. We set to work at the sink as we did most nights, except that I couldn't shut up. I told him about the crap game. I told him about the FBI agent. I told him about Mr. Wishnow. "He didn't die in his bed," I said. "Mother's not telling us the truth. He committed suicide, only she doesn't want to say it. Selden found him in the closet when he got home from school. He hung himself. That's why the police came." "Did he turn colors?" my brother asked me. "I only saw him under the sheet. Maybe it was colors. I don't know. I don't want to know. It was bad enough when they jiggled the stretcher that you could see him move." That I had thought at first it was my father under the sheet, I didn't say aloud for fear that if I did, it would turn out to be true. The fact that my father was alive, vividly alive, angry at Alvin and threatening to throw him out of the house, had no impact on my thinking. "How do you know he was in the closet?" Sandy asked. "That's what all the kids said." "And you believed them?" "Because of his fame, he was becoming a very hard boy whose tremendous confidence now sounded more and more like lordly arrogance whenever he spoke about me or my friends." "Well, why were all the police here?" "Just because he died? People die all the time," I said, trying, however, not to believe it. "He killed himself. He had to." "And is that against the law, killing yourself?" my brother asked me. "What were they going to do, put him in jail for killing himself?" I didn't know. I didn't know any longer what the law was, and so I didn't know what might or might not be against it. I didn't seem to know whether my own father, who just headed downstairs with my mother, was really alive, or pretending to be alive, or being driven around dead in the back of that ambulance. I didn't know anything. I didn't know why Alvin was bad now instead of good. I didn't know if I had dreamed that an FBI agent had questioned me on Chancellor Avenue. It had to be a dream, and yet couldn't be if everybody else said they'd been questioned too. Unless that was the dream. I felt woozy, and I thought I was going to faint. I'd never before seen anyone faint other than in a movie, and I'd never before fainted myself. I'd never before looked at my house from a hiding place across the street and wished that it was somebody else's. I'd never before had $20 in my pocket. I'd never before known anyone who'd seen his father hanging in a closet. I'd never before had to grow up at a pace like this. Never before. The great refrain of 1942. You better call Mom, I told my brother. Call her. Tell her to come home right away. But before Sandy could reach the back door to rush down to the Wishnows, I was vomiting into the dish towel still in my hand. And when I collapsed, it was because my leg had been blown off and my blood was everywhere. I remained in bed with a high fever for 6 days, so weak and lifeless that the family doctor stopped by every evening to check on the progress of my disease. That not uncommon childhood ailment called, why can it be the way it was? The next day for me was Sunday. It was late afternoon, and Uncle Monty was visiting. Alvin was there too. And from what I could overhear from my bed of what was being said in the kitchen, he hadn't been seen anywhere around since Mr. Wishnow had committed suicide on Friday, and he walked away from that crap game with his bundle of 5s, 10s, and 20s. But since dinner time Friday, I'd been away myself, off with the horses and their hooves, enveloped by kaleidoscopic hallucinations of the orphanage workhorses pursuing me to the edge of the earth. And now, Uncle Monty again. Again, Uncle Monty attacking Alvin, and with words I could not believe were being spoken in our house in the presence of my mother. But then, Uncle Monty knew how to subdue Alvin in ways that my father just couldn't employ. By nightfall, after all the shouting had subsided into lamentations from my late Uncle Jack and Monty's booming voice had gone hoarse, Alvin accepted the job at the produce market that he refused to consider when Monty had offered it first. As unmanned as he'd been by his mutilation on the morning he arrived at Penn Station in the care of that hulking Canadian nurse, as overridden by defeat as when, from his wheelchair, he wouldn't dare to look a one of us in the eye, Alvin consented to dissolve his partnership with Shushi and to give up gambling on the neighborhood streets. A hater no less of subservience than of weeping, he astonished everyone by breaking into guilty tears and begging forgiveness, and agreeing to stop being a brute to my brother, an ingrate to my mother and father, and a bad influence on me, and to treat us with the appreciation we were due. Uncle Monty warned Alvin that if he didn't abide by his promises and continued instead to sabotage Herman's household, the Roths would be finished with him for good. Though Alvin appeared to be trying hard to make a go of the menial donkey work that was his first job, he didn't last long enough at the market to rise even a notch above sweeping and fetching. One day, when he'd been there a little more than a week, the FBI came around to inquire about him. The same agent, using the same menacingly innocuous questions he asked my family and me, only insinuating now to the other produce workers that Alvin was a self-declared traitor plotting with anti-American malcontents like himself to assassinate President Lindbergh. The charges were ludicrous, and yet, tame as Alvin had been all that week, tame as he'd sworn and dedicated himself to remaining, he was fired on the spot and, on the way out, instructed by one of the goons in charge never to come anywhere near the market again. When my father got on the phone to his brother demanding to know what had happened, Monty replied that he had no choice. He'd been ordered to get rid of his nephew by Longy's boys. Newark's Longy's Willman, who'd grown up like my father and his brothers, a son of immigrants in the old Jewish slums, ran the Jersey rackets back then. The ruthless potentate of everything, from bookmaking and strike-breaking to the trucking and hauling services foisted on merchants like Belmont Roth. Because the feds were the last people Longy needed snooping around, Alvin lost the job, cleared out of our house, and left the city in under 24 hours, this time not across the international border for Montreal and the Canadian commandos, but just over the Delaware for Philadelphia and a job with Shushy's uncle, the gambling machine king. A racketeer seemingly more tolerant of traitors than his peerless counterpart up in North Jersey. In the spring of 1942, to celebrate the success of the Iceland Understanding, a state dinner was given at the White House by President and Mrs. Lindbergh to honor Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop, who was known to have touted Lindbergh to his Nazi colleagues as Germany's ideal American presidential candidate long before the Republican Party drafted Lindbergh at its 1940 convention. Von Ribbentrop was the negotiator seated at Hitler's side throughout the Iceland meetings and the first Nazi leader to be invited to America by any government official or agency since the fascists had come to power nearly 10 years before. No sooner was the announcement of the von Ribbentrop dinner made public than strong criticism was voiced by the liberal press, and rallies and demonstrations were staged all across the country protesting the White House decision. For the first time since he left office, former President Roosevelt emerged from seclusion to make a brief nationwide address from Hyde Park, urging President Lindbergh to rescind the invitation for the sake of all freedom-loving Americans, and particularly the tens of millions of Americans of European stock whose ancestral countries must live beneath the Nazis' crushing yoke. Roosevelt was immediately attacked by Vice President Wheeler for playing politics with a sitting president's conduct of foreign affairs. It wasn't merely cynical, said the vice president, but utterly irresponsible of him to argue for the same dangerous policies that had all but dragged America into a bloody European war while the New Deal Democrats were running the country. Wheeler was himself a Democrat, a former three-term senator from Montana, and the first and only member of the opposition party to be chosen to share a ticket with a presidential candidate since Lincoln picked Andrew Johnson as his second-term running mate in 1864. Early in his political career, Wheeler was so far to the left that he'd been the voice of Butte's radical labor leaders, the enemy of Anaconda Copper, the mining company that ran Montana pretty much like a company store, and, as an early supporter of FDR's, had been suggested as his vice presidential candidate in 1932. He'd first departed the Democratic Party in 1924 to team up with Wisconsin's reformist senator, Robert La Follette, on the union-supported Progressive Party presidential ticket. And then, after subsequently abandoning La Follette and his supporters in the non-communist American left, he joined Lindbergh and the right-wing isolationists in helping to found America First, attacking Roosevelt with anti-war statements so extreme that they prompted the president to label his criticism, quote, the most untruthful, dastardly, unpatriotic thing that has been said in public life in my generation. Wheeler had been chosen by the Republicans to be Lindbergh's running mate, in part because his own political machine in Montana had helped to elect Republicans to Congress throughout the late 30s, but mainly to persuade the American people of the strength of the bipartisan support for isolationism, and to have on the ticket a combative, un-Lindbergh-like candidate whose job would be to attack and revile his own political party at every opportunity, as he did in the press conference from the vice president's office when he predicted that if the reckless, war-minded rhetoric in Roosevelt's message from Hyde Park was any indication of the campaign the Democrats intended to wage in the forthcoming elections, they would suffer even greater congressional losses than they had in the 1940 Republican landslide. The very next weekend, the German-American Bund filled Madison Square Garden with a near-capacity crowd, some 25,000 people, who had turned out to support President Lindbergh's invitation to the German foreign minister and to denounce the Democrats for their renewed warmongering. During Roosevelt's second term, the FBI and congressional committees investigating the Bund's activities had immobilized the organization, designating it a Nazi front and bringing criminal charges against its leaders and its high command. But under Lindbergh, government efforts at harassing or intimidating Bund members ceased, and they were able to regain their strength by identifying themselves not only as American patriots of German extraction opposed to American intervention in foreign wars, but as staunch enemies of the Soviet Union. The deep fascist fellowship uniting the Bund was now masked by vociferous patriotic declamations on the peril of a worldwide communist revolution. As an anti-communist, rather than a pro-Nazi organization, the Bund was as anti-Semitic as before, openly equating Bolshevism with Judaism in propaganda handouts and harping on the number of pro-war Jews, like Treasury Secretary Morgenthau and financier Bernard Baruch, who had been Roosevelt's confidants, and of course, holding fast to the purposes enunciated in their official declaration on first organizing in 1936. To combat the Moscow-directed madness of the Red World Menace and its Jewish bacillus carriers, and to promote a free Gentile-ruled United States. Gone, however, from the 1942 Madison Square Garden rally were the Nazi flags, the swastika armbands, the straight-armed Hitler salute, the stormtrooper uniforms, and the giant picture of the Führer that had been on display for the first rally on February 20th, 1939, an event promoted by the Bund as George Washington Day birthday exercises. Gone were the wall banners proclaiming, "Wake up, America, smash Jewish communists," and the references by speechmakers to Franklin D. Roosevelt as Franklin D. Rosenfeld, and the big white buttons with the black lettering that had been distributed to Bund members to stick into their lapels. The buttons that read, "Keep America out of the Jewish War." Meanwhile, Walter Winchell continued to refer to the Bundists as Bundits, and Dorothy Thompson, the prominent journalist and wife of novelist Sinclair Lewis, who'd been expelled from the 1939 Bund rally for exercising what she called her constitutional right to laugh at ridiculous statements in a public hall, went on denouncing their propaganda in the same spirit she demonstrated 3 years earlier when she exited the rally shouting, "Bunk, bunk, bunk, Mein Kampf, word for word." And on his Sunday night program following the Bund rally, Winchell contended with his usual cocksureness that growing hostility to the von Ribbentrop state dinner marked the end of America's honeymoon with Charles A. Lindbergh. "The presidential blunder of the century," Winchell called it. "The blunder of blunders for which the reactionary Republican henchmen of our fascist-loving president will pay with their political lives in the November elections." The White House, accustomed to nearly universal deification of Lindbergh, seemed stymied by the strong disapproval that the opposition was so rapidly able to muster against him. And though the administration sought to distance itself from the Bund's New York rally, the Democrats, determined to associate Lindbergh with the organization's ignominious reputation, held a Madison Square Garden rally on their own. Speaker after speaker scathingly denounced the Lindbergh Bundists until, to everyone's astonished delight, FDR himself appeared on the platform. The 10-minute ovation his presence elicited would have gone on even longer had not the former president called out forcefully above the roar,
My fellow Americans, I have a message for both Mr. Lindbergh and Mr. Hitler. The moment compels my stating, with a candor they cannot misunderstand, that it is we, and not they, who are the masters of America's destiny."
Words so stirring and dramatic that every human being in that crowd, and in our living room, and in the living rooms up and down our street, was swept away by the joyous illusion that the nation's redemption was at hand.
"The only thing we have to fear," FDR told his audience, recalling the opening 7 words of a sentence as renowned as any ever spoken at a first inaugural, "is the obsequious yielding to his Nazi friends by Charles A. Lindbergh, the shameless courting by the president of the world's greatest democracy, of a despot responsible for innumerable criminal deeds and acts of savagery, a cruel and barbaric tyrant unparalleled in the chronicle of man's misdeeds. But we Americans will not accept a Hitler-dominated America. We Americans will not accept a Hitler-dominated world. Today, the entire globe is divided between human slavery and human freedom. We choose freedom. We accept only an America consecrated to freedom. If there is a plot being hatched by anti-democratic forces here at home, harboring a quisling blueprint for a fascist America, or by foreign nations greedy for power and supremacy, a plot to suppress the great upsurge of human liberty of which the American Bill of Rights is the fundamental document, a plot to replace American democracy with the absolute authority of a despotic rule such as enslaves the conquered people of Europe, let those who would dare in secret to conspire against our freedom understand that Americans will not, under any threat or in the face of any danger, surrender the guarantees of liberty framed for us by our forefathers in the Constitution of the United States.
Lindbergh's response came a few days afterward. He donned his Lone Eagle flying gear and early one morning took off from Washington in his two-engine Lockheed Interceptor to meet with the American people face to face and reassure them that every decision he made was designed solely to increase their security and guarantee their well-being. That's what he did when the smallest crisis loomed. Flew to cities in every region of the country, this time to as many as 4 and 5 in a single day owing to the interceptor's phenomenal speed. And everywhere his plane set down, the cluster of radio microphones was waiting for him, as were the local bigwigs, the wire service stringers, the city's reporters, and the thousands of citizens who had gathered to catch sight of their young president in his famous aviator's windbreaker and leather cap. And each time he landed, he made it clear that he was flying the country unescorted, without either Secret Service or Air Corps protection. This was how safe he considered the American skies to be. This was how secure the country was, now that his administration, in little more than a year, had dispelled all threat of war. He reminded his audiences that the life of not a single American boy had been put at risk since he'd come to office, and would not be put at risk so long as he remained in office. Americans had invested their faith in his leadership, and every promise he had made to them, he had kept. That was all he said, or had to say. He never mentioned von Ribbentrop's name, or FDR's, or made reference to the German-American Bund, or the Iceland Understanding. He said nothing in support of the Nazis, nothing to reveal an affinity with their leader and his aims, not even to note with approval that the German army had recovered from its winter losses and that all along the Russian front, the Soviet communists were being pushed farther eastward toward their ultimate defeat. But then, everyone in America knew that it was an unshakable conviction of the president's, as it was of his party's dominant right wing, that the best protection against the spread of communism across Europe into Asia and the Middle East, and as far as to our own hemisphere, was the total destruction of Stalin's Soviet Union by the military might of the Third Reich. In his low-key, taciturn, winning way, Lindbergh told the airfield crowds and the radio listeners who he was and what he'd done, and by the time he climbed back aboard his plane to take off for his next stop, he could have announced that, following the von Ribbentrop White House dinner, the First Lady would be inviting Adolf Hitler and his girlfriend to spend the 4th of July weekend as vacation guests in the Lincoln bedroom of the White House and still have been cheered by his countrymen as democracy's savior. My father's boyhood friend, Shepsie Tershwell, had been one of several projectionist editors at the Newsreel Theater on Broad Street since its opening in 1935 as the city's only all-news movie house. The Newsreel's one-hour show comprised news clips, shorts, and The March of Time, and it ran daily from early morning until midnight. Every Thursday, out of thousands of feet of news films supplied by companies like Pathé and Paramount, Mr. Tershwell and the three other editors selected stories and spliced together an up-to-the-minute show so that regular customers like my father, whose office on Clinton Street was only a few blocks away, could keep pace with national news, important happenings worldwide, and exciting moments from championship sports matches that, back in the radio era, could be seen on film nowhere but at a movie theater. My father would try to find an hour each week to catch a complete show,
And when he did, he'd recount over dinner what he'd seen and whom. Tojo, Patan, Batista, De Valera, Arias, Quezon, Camacho, Litvinov, Zhukov, Hull, Wells, Harriman, Dyes, Heydrich, Bloom, Quisling, Gandhi, Rommel, Mountbatten, King George, LaGuardia, Franco, Pope Pius. And that was but an abbreviated list of the tremendous cast of newsreel characters prominent in events that my father told us we would one day remember as history, worthy of passing on to our own children. Because, what's history? He asked rhetorically when he was in his expansive dinner-time instructional mode. History is everything that happens everywhere, even here in Newark, even here on Summit Avenue. Even what happens in his house to an ordinary man, that'll be history too someday. On the weekends, when Mr. Tershwell was working, my father would take Sandy and me to be further educated at the Newsreel Theater. Mr. Tershwell would leave free passes at the box office for us, and each time my father brought us up to the projection booth after the show, would give the same civics lecture. He'd tell us that, in a democracy, keeping abreast of current events was a citizen's most important duty, and that you could never start too early to be informed about the news of the day. We'd gather close to the film projector, each of whose parts he'd name for us, and then we'd look at the framed photographs on the walls that had been taken at the theater's black tie opening night, when Newark's first and only Jewish mayor, Meyer Ellenstein, had cut the ribbon strung across the lobby and welcomed the famous guests, among whom, as Mr. Tershwell told us, pointing to their pictures, was the former U.S. ambassador to Spain and the founder of Bamberger's department store. What I liked best about the Newsreel Theater was that the seats were constructed so that even an adult didn't have to get up to let others by, that the projection booth was said to be soundproof, and that on the carpet in the lobby was a design of motion picture reels that you could step on when you came in and out. Not until I think back to those consecutive Saturdays in 1942, when Sandy was 14 and I was 9, and we were taken by my father specifically to see the Bund rally one week and FDR addressing the anti-Ribbentrop garden rally the next, am I able to remember anything much other than the narrating voice of Lowell Thomas, who introduced most of the political news, and of Bill Stern, who enthusiastically reported on sports. But the Bund rally I've not forgotten, because of the hatred instilled in me by the Bundists up on their feet chanting von Ribbentrop's name as though it were he who is now President of the United States. And FDR's speech I've not forgotten because when he proclaimed to the anti-Ribbentrop rally,
"The only thing we have to fear is the obsequious yielding to his Nazi friends by Charles A. Lindbergh," a good half of the movie audience booed and hissed while the rest, including my father, clapped as loudly as they could. And I wondered if a war might not break out right there on Broad Street in the middle of the day, and if, when we left the darkened theater, we'd find downtown Newark a rubble heap of smoking ruins and fires burning everywhere. It wasn't easy for Sandy to sit through those two Saturday afternoon shows at the Newsreel Theater. And since he'd already understood beforehand that it wasn't going to be, he had first refused my father's invitation and agreed to come along with us only when he was ordered to do so. By the spring of 1942, Sandy was a few months from beginning high school, a lean, tall, good-looking boy whose attire was neat, whose hair was combed, and whose posture, standing or sitting, was as perfect as a West Point cadet's. His experience as a leading young spokesman for Just Folks had endowed him, in addition, with an air of authority seldom seen in one so young. That Sandy should prove himself so adept at influencing adults, and that he should have developed a reverential following among the younger neighborhood kids who were eager to emulate him and qualify for the Office of American Absorption Summer Farm Program, had surprised my parents and made their older child more intimidating to have around the house than he was back when everyone thought of him as an affable, fairly ordinary boy with a gift for drawing people's likenesses. To me, he'd always been the mighty one because of his seniority. Now he seemed mightier than ever and easily aroused my admiration despite my having turned away from him because of what Alvin had described as his opportunism. Though even the opportunism, if Alvin was correct and that was the word for it, seemed another remarkable attainment.
the emblem of a calm, self-aware maturity, knowingly wedded to the ways of the world. Of course, the concept of opportunism was barely familiar to me at the age of 9. Yet its ethical status, Alvin communicated clearly enough by the disgust with which he pronounced his indictment and what he added by way of amplification. He was still fresh from the hospital then, and far too miserable to show much restraint. "Your brother's nothing," he informed me from his bed one night. "He's less than nothing." And that was when he labeled Sandy opportunistic. Is he? Why? Because people are. Because they look for the advantage for themselves and the hell with everything else. Sandy's a fucking opportunist. So's your bitch aunt with the big pointy tits. So's the great rabbi. Aunt Bess and Uncle Herman are honest people, but Sandy, selling out to these bastards right off the bat at his age, with his talent? Real fucking doozy, this brother of yours. Selling out. Language also new to me, but now no more difficult to understand than opportunist. "He just drew some pictures," I explained. But Alvin was in no mood to have me try to downplay the existence of those pictures, especially as he'd somehow come to know about Sandy's affiliation with Lindbergh's Just Folks. I didn't have the courage to ask him how he found out what I determined never to tell him. Though what I figured was that, after accidentally uncovering the artwork beneath the bed, he must have gone ahead to scavenge the drawers of the dining room break front where Sandy stored his school notebooks and his writing paper, and found there all the evidence necessary to hate Sandy forever. "It doesn't mean what you think," I said, but immediately I had to think what else it could mean. "He's doing it to protect us," I announced, "so we don't get in trouble." "Because of me," Alvin said. "No," I protested. "But that's what he told you. So the family won't get in trouble because of Alvin. That's how he justifies the shit he's up to." "But why else would he be doing it?" I asked this as guilelessly as a child could and with all of a child's cunning, and with no idea of how to begin to extricate myself from a conflict I had only intensified by lying idiotically in my brother's defense. "What's wrong with what he's doing if he's trying to help?" He merely replied, "I don't believe you, Ace." And because I was no match for Alvin, I gave up trying to believe myself. Though if only Sandy had told me he was leading a double existence, if only he was making the best of a terrible situation and masquerading as a Lindbergh loyalist to protect us. But having seen him lecturing an audience of Jewish adults in that New Brunswick synagogue basement, I knew how convinced he was of what he was saying and how he gorged on the attention it brought him. My brother had discovered in himself the uncommon gift to be somebody. And so, while making speeches praising President Lindbergh and while exhibiting his drawings of him and while publicly extolling, in words written by Aunt Evelyn, the enriching benefits of his 8 weeks as a Jewish farmhand in the Gentile heartland, while doing, if the truth be known, what I wouldn't have minded doing myself, by doing what was normal and patriotic all over America and aberrant and freakish only in his home, Sandy was having the time of his life. Then came history's next outsized intrusion, an engraved invitation from President and Mrs. Charles A. Lindbergh for Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf and Miss Evelyn Finkel to attend a state dinner in honor of the German foreign minister on the evening of Saturday, April 4th, 1942. The cross-country solo flying tour of 30 cities had raised Lindbergh's reputation as a no-nonsense realist and plain-talking man of the people higher even than it had been before Winchell had labeled the von Ribbentrop dinner the political blunder of the century. Soon, the editorial pages of the country's largely Republican press were crowing that it was FDR and the Democrats whose blunder it had been to deliberately misrepresent as a sinister conspiracy what was no more than a cordial White House dinner for a foreign dignitary. Stunned as my parents were to learn of the invitation, there was nothing much for them to do about it. Months earlier, they had registered with Evelyn their disappointment in her for having become another of the small band of misguided Jews to serve as underlings to those now in power. It made no sense to challenge, yet again, her remote administrative connection to the President of the United States, especially since they knew it was an ideological conviction that animated her, as it appeared to have, back in her union days, or just craven political ambition. But the exhilaration
of having been rescued by Rabbi Bengelsdorf from her life as a substitute teacher living in an attic flat on Dewey Street and removed to a life at court as miraculously as Cinderella. However, when she phoned unexpectedly one evening to tell my mother that she and the rabbi had arranged for my brother to accompany them to the von Ribbentrop dinner, well, at first no one was willing to believe her. It was still barely possible to accept that Evelyn could herself have stepped overnight from our local little society into March of Time celebrity. But now, Sandy as well? His preaching for Lindbergh in synagogue basements wasn't improbable enough? This simply could not be so, my father insisted, meaning that it mustn't be so, that, credibility aside, it was too repellent to be so. It only proves, he told my brother, that your aunt is nuts. And maybe she was. Driven temporarily nuts by an exaggerated sense of her newfound importance. How else could she have mustered the audacity to seek an invitation to such a great event for her 14-year-old nephew? How else could she have prevailed on Rabbi Bengelsdorf to make so outlandish a request of the White House other than by insisting with the uncompromising tenacity of a self-absorbed screwball on the way up? Over the phone, my father spoke to her as calmly as he could. Enough of this foolishness, Evelyn. We're not important people. Leave us alone, please. There's too much for an ordinary person to put up with as it is. But my aunt's commitment to liberating an exceptional nephew from the confines of an ignorant brother-in-law's insignificance so that he could play a leading role in the world like her was by now unassailable. Sandy was to attend the dinner as a testament to the success of Just Folks. He was to attend as nothing less than the nationwide representative of Just Folks, and no ghetto father was going to stop him or her. She got in her car, and 15 minutes later, the reckoning came. After he hung up, my father did nothing to conceal his outrage, and his voice rose and rose as if he were Uncle Monty. In Germany, Hitler has the decency at least to bar the Jews from the Nazi party. That and the armbands. That and the concentration camps. And at least it's clear that dirty Jews aren't welcome. But here, the Nazis pretend to invite the Jews in. And why? To lull them to sleep. To lull them to sleep with the ridiculous dream that everything in America is hunky-dory. But this, he cried, this, inviting them to shake the blood-stained hand of a Nazi criminal. Unbelievable. They're lying and their scheming do not stop for a minute. They find the best boy, the most talented boy, the hardest working, most grown-up boy. No. They have mocked us enough with what they are doing to Sandy. He is not going anywhere. They have already stolen my country. They are not stealing my son. But nobody, Sandy shouted, is mocking anybody. This is a great opportunity. For an opportunist, I thought, but kept my mouth shut. Be still, my father told him. Just that. And the quiet sternness was more effective than the anger in causing Sandy to understand that he was on the brink of the worst hour of his life. Aunt Evelyn was knocking, and my mother got up to open the back door. What is this woman doing now? My father called after her. I tell her to leave us alone, and so here she comes, crazy as a coot. My mother was by no means at odds with my father's resolve, but she did manage to look imploringly at him as she left the kitchen, hoping she might dispose him to be somewhat merciful, however little mercy Evelyn deserved for the reckless stupidity with which she had exploited Sandy's zeal. Aunt Evelyn was astonished, or pretended to be, by my parents' inability to grasp what it meant for a boy Sandy's age to be invited to the White House, what it would mean for his future to have been a dinner guest at the White House. I am not impressed by the White House, my father cried, hammering on the table to shut her up after she said, the White House, for the 15th time. I am only impressed by who lives there, and the person who lives there is a Nazi. He is not, Evelyn insisted. And do you want to tell me that Herr von Ribbentrop isn't a Nazi either? In response, she called my father a frightened, provincial, uncultivated, narrow-minded, and he called her an unthinking, gullible, social climbing, and the quarrel raged across the table, each hotly spitting out indictments to increase the fury of the other. until something Anne Evelyn said, something relatively mild as it turned out, about all the strings Rabbi Bengelsdorf had pulled for Sandy was one absurdity too many for him, and he got up from the table and told her to leave. He walked out of the kitchen and into the rear foyer, where he opened the door to the stairwell, and from there he called to her, "Get out, go, and don't come back. I never want to see you in this house again." She couldn't believe it any more than the rest of us. It seemed to me to be a joke, a line tossed off in an Abbott and Costello movie. "Get out, Costello. If you're going to carry on like that, leave this house and never come back." My mother got up from where the three adults had been sitting with their tea and followed him out into the foyer. "The woman is an idiot, Bess," my father said to her. "A childish idiot who understands nothing. A dangerous idiot." "Close the door, please," my mother said to him. "Evelyn," he called, "now, immediately, leave." "Don't do this," my mother whispered. "I am waiting for your sister to get out of my house," he replied. "Our house," my mother said, and she came back into the kitchen. "Ev, go home," she said softly, "so everything can quiet down." Aunt Evelyn's face was on the table, hidden in her hands. My mother took her by the arm and lifted her to her feet and walked her to the back door and out of the house. Our assertive, effervescent aunt, looking as though she had been hit by a bullet and was being carried off to die. Then we heard my father slam the door. "The woman thinks it's a party," he said to Sandy and me when we stepped out into the foyer to view the aftermath of the battle. "She thinks it's a game. You've been to the newsreel theater. I took you boys. You know what you saw there." "Yes," I said. I felt I had to say something, since my brother was now refusing to speak. He had stoically endured Alvin's remorseless ostracism, and he had stoically endured the newsreel theater, and now he was stoically enduring the banishment of his favorite aunt. At 14, already at one with the family's obstinate men, determined to stand up to anything. "Well," my father said, "it's not a game. It's a fight. Remember that. A fight." Again, I said yes. "Outside, in the world..." But here he stopped. My mother hadn't returned. I was 9 and thought she would never return. And it may have been that my father, at 41, thought so too. My father, who had been freed by hardship of many fears, was not free of the fear of losing his precious wife. Catastrophe was no longer far from anyone's mind, and he was looking at his children as though he was suddenly as bereft of a mother as Earl Axman was on the night of Mrs. Axman's nervous breakdown. When my father went to the living room to look out the front windows, Sandy and I trailed closely behind. Anne Evelyn's car was no longer at the curb, and my mother wasn't standing on the sidewalk or on the stoop or out in the alleyway or even across the street. Nor was she in the cellar when my father ran down the cellar stairs calling her name. Nor was she with Selden and his mother. They were eating in their kitchen when my father knocked and the three of us were let in. My father said to Mrs. Wishnow, "Did you see Bess?" Mrs. Wishnow was a beefy woman, tall and ungainly, who walked around with her fists clenched and who, amazingly to me, was said to have been a laughing, light-hearted girl when my father knew her and her family down in the Third Ward before the Great War. Now that she was both mother and family breadwinner, my parents were constantly extolling her unstinting exertions in behalf of Selden. That her life was a fight was indisputable. You had only to look at her fists. "What's wrong?" she asked him. "Isn't Bess here?" Selden left the kitchen table to come out and say hello to us. Since his father's suicide, my aversion to him had grown stronger. And at the end of the day, I hid back of the school when I knew he was out front waiting to walk me home. And though we lived just one short block from the school, in the morning I tiptoed down the stairs and leave the house 15 minutes before I had to in order to beat him out the door. But then, late in the afternoon, I would invariably run into him, even if I was at the other end of the Chancellor Avenue Hill. I'd be on a household errand, and there would be Selden at my heels, acting as if he turned up by accident. And whenever he came by to try to teach me to play chess, I would pretend I wasn't home and not answer the door. If my mother was around, she would try to persuade me to play with him by reminding me of the very thing that I wanted to forget. His father was a wonderful chess player. Years ago, he was champion at the Y. He taught Selden, and now Selden has no one to play with, and he wants to play with you.
I'd tell her that I didn't like or understand the game or know how to play it. But finally, there'd be no choice, and Selden would show up with the chessboard and his chessmen, and I'd sit down across from him at the kitchen table, where he'd immediately begin to remind me how his father had made the board and found the chess pieces. He went into New York, and he knew just the places to go, and he found just the right pieces. Aren't they beautiful? They're made of special wood, and he made this board. He found the wood, and he cut it. You see how the different colors are? And the only way I found to stop him from perpetually going on about his terrifyingly dead father was to bombard him with the latest toilet jokes I'd heard at school. When we were headed upstairs again, I realized that my father was now going to marry Mrs. Wishnow, and that one evening soon, the three of us would carry our belongings down the back stairway and move in with her and Selden, and that on the way to school, as on the way home, there would be no way ever again of avoiding Selden and his unceasing need to draw sustenance from me. And once back in the house, I would have to put my coat away in the closet where Selden's father had hanged himself. Sandy would sleep in the Wishnow sun parlor, as he had in ours when Alvin lived with us. I'd sleep in the back bedroom beside Selden, while in the other bedroom, my father would sleep where Selden's father used to sleep, alongside Selden's mother and her clenched fists. I wanted to go to the corner and get on a bus and disappear. I still had Alvin's $20 hidden in the tip of my shoe at the bottom of my closet. I'd take the money and get on a bus and down at Penn Station buy a one-way ticket for the train to Philadelphia. There, I would find Alvin and never live with my family again. Instead, I would stay with Alvin and look after his stump. My mother called home after she had put Evelyn to bed. Rabbi Bengelsdorf was in Washington, but he had talked with Evelyn on the phone and afterward spoke to my mother, assuring her that he knew better than her dunce of a husband what was and was not in the interest of the Jews. How Herman had treated Evelyn would not be forgotten, he said, especially after all he himself had gone out of his way to do for her nephew at Evelyn's request. The rabbi concluded by telling my mother that appropriate action would be taken when the time came. Around 10, my father went to pick my mother up and drive her home. Sandy and I were already in pajamas when she came into the room and sat down on my bed and took my hand. I'd never seen her so exhausted. Not completely depleted like Mrs. Wishnow, but hardly the untiring mother, full of contentment who used to live so energetically inside her skin, back when her worries were merely the ones of making do for her family on a husband's take-home pay of less than $50 a week. A downtown job, a house to run, a tempestuous sister, a determined husband, a headstrong 14-year-old, an apprehensive 9-year-old, not even the simultaneous inundation of all these concerns, with all their exacting demands, need have been overly burdensome for a woman so resourceful. If only there weren't Lindbergh, too. Sandy, she said, what shall we do? Should I explain to you why Daddy doesn't think you should go? Can we do that together quietly? At some point, we have to talk everything through, just you and me off by ourselves. Sometimes Daddy can fly off the handle, but I don't. You know that. You can trust me to listen to you. But we have to get some perspective on what is going on. Because maybe it really isn't a good thing for you to be drawn any further into something like this. Maybe Aunt Evelyn made a mistake. She's overexcited, darling. She's been like that all her life. Something out of the ordinary happens, and she loses all perspective. Daddy thinks, shall I continue, dear, or do you want to go to sleep? Do what you want, Sandy said flatly. Continue, I said. My mother smiled at me. Why? What do you want to know? What everyone's yelling for? Because everybody sees things differently. Kissing me goodnight, she said, because there's a lot on everyone's mind. But when she leaned toward Sandy's bed to kiss him, he turned his face into the pillow. Usually, my father was off to work before Sandy and I were awake,
and my mother would be up early to eat breakfast with him and to make our lunch sandwiches and wrap them in wax paper and put them in the refrigerator, and then would herself leave for work after seeing that we two were ready for school. The following day, however, my father didn't leave for his office until he'd had a chance to clarify for Sandy why he was not going to the White House and why he was no longer to participate in any of the programs sponsored by the OAA. "These friends of von Ribbentrop," he explained to Sandy, "are no friends of ours. Every dirty scheme that Hitler has foisted on Europe, every filthy lie he has told other countries, has come through the mouth of Mr. von Ribbentrop. Someday, you'll study what happened at Munich. You'll study the role that Mr. von Ribbentrop played in tricking Mr. Chamberlain into signing a treaty that wasn't worth the paper it was written on. Read PM about this man. Listen to Winchell about this man. Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop, Winchell calls him. You know what he did for a living before the war? Sold champagne. A liquor salesman, Sandy. A fake. A plutocrat and a thief and a fake. Even the von in his name is a fake. But you know none of this. You know nothing about von Ribbentrop. You know nothing about Goering. You know nothing about Goebbels and Himmler and Hess. But I do know. Did you ever hear about the castle in Austria where Herr von Ribbentrop wines and dines the rest of the Nazi criminals? Know how he got it? He stole it. The nobleman who owned it, Himmler, threw into a concentration camp. And now it is the property of the liquor salesman. Do you know where Danzig is, Sandy? And what happened to it? Do you know what the Treaty of Versailles is? Did you hear of Mein Kampf? Ask Mr. von Ribbentrop. He'll tell you. And I will tell you, too, though not from the Nazi point of view. I follow things, and I read things, and I know who these criminals are, son, and I am not allowing you anywhere near them. I'll never forgive you for this, Sandy replied. But you will, my mother said to him. One day, you'll understand that what Daddy wants for you is only what's in your best interest. He's right, dear. Believe me. You have no business with such people. They are only making you their tool. Aunt Evelyn? Sandy asked. Aunt Evelyn is making me into a tool? Getting me invited to the White House? That's making me into a tool? Yes, my mother said sadly. No, that isn't true, he said. I'm sorry, but I can't let Aunt Evelyn down. Your Aunt Evelyn, my father told him, is the one who let us down. Just folks, he said contemptuously. The only purpose of this so-called just folks is to make Jewish children into a fifth column and turn them against their parents. Bullshit, Sandy said. Stop that, my mother said. Stop that right now. Do you realize that we're the only family on the block going through anything like this? The only family in this entire neighborhood. Everybody else knows by now just to continue living as they were living before the election and to forget who the president is. And that's what we're doing, too. Bad things have happened, but now they're over. Alvin is gone, and now Aunt Evelyn is gone, and everything is going to get back to normal. And when are we moving to Canada? Sandy asked her. Because of your persecution complex. Pointing his finger, my father said, Don't mimic your stupid aunt. Don't talk back like that ever again. You're a dictator, Sandy said to him. You're a dictator worse than Hitler. Because my parents had each been raised in a household where an old country father had not hesitated to discipline his children in accordance with traditional methods of coercion, they were themselves incapable of ever hitting Sandy or me and disapproved of corporal punishment for anyone. Consequently, all my father did in response to being told by a child of his that he was worse than Hitler, was to turn away in disgust and leave for work. But he was hardly out the back door when my mother raised her hand and, to my astonishment, smacked Sandy across the face. Do you know what your father has just done for you? She shouted at him. Don't you understand yet what you were about to do to yourself? Finish your breakfast and go to school and you'll be home when school is over. Your father laid down the law, you better obey it. He didn't flinch when she hit him, and now, all resistance, he undertook to enlarge his heroism by brazenly telling her, I'm going to the White House with Aunt Evelyn. I don't care whether you ghetto Jews like it or not. To add to the morning's ugliness, to add to the nerve-shattering implausibility of all our disorder, she made him pay in full for his filial defiance by dealing him a second blow, and this time he burst into tears. And had he not,
this prudent mother of ours would have raised her gentle, kindly mothering hand and hit him a third, a fourth, and a fifth time. She doesn't know what she's doing, I thought. She's somebody else. Everybody is. And I grabbed my school books and ran down the back stairs to the alleyway and out to the street, and as if the day weren't already gruesome enough, there was Selden waiting on the front stoop to walk me to school. On the way home from work a couple of weeks later, my father stopped off at the Newsreel Theater to catch the film coverage of the von Ribbentrop dinner. It was then that he learned from Shep C. Tirschwell, whom he visited up in his booth after the show, that on the 1st of June, his old boyhood friend was leaving for Winnipeg with his wife, his three children, his mother, and his wife's elderly parents. Representatives of Winnipeg's small Jewish community had helped Mr. Tirschwell to find work as a projectionist at a neighborhood movie house there and had located apartments for the entire family in a modest Jewish neighborhood, much like our own. The Canadians had also arranged a low-interest loan to pay for the Tirschwell's move from America and to assist with the support of the in-laws until Mrs. Tirschwell found a job in Winnipeg that would enable her to cover her parents' living expenses. Mr. Tirschwell told my father that he hated parting from his native city and his dear old friends, and that, of course, he regretted leaving his one-of-a-kind job at Newark's most important theater. There was much to leave and much to lose, but he was convinced by all the raw, unedited film he'd been watching for the past several years from newsreel crews working around the world that the secret side of the pact reached in Iceland between Lindbergh and Hitler in 1941 provided for Hitler first to defeat the Soviet Union, then to invade and conquer England, and only after that, and after the Japanese had overrun China, India, and Australia, thus completing the creation of their new order in Greater East Asia, for America's president to establish the American Fascist New Order, a totalitarian dictatorship modeled on Hitler's that would set the stage for the last great continental struggle, the German invasion, conquest, and Nazification of South America. 2 years down the line, with Hitler's swastika flying from London's Houses of Parliament, the rising sun flying over Sydney, New Delhi, and Peking, and Lindbergh having been elected to the presidency for another 4 years, the U.S. border with Canada would be closed, diplomatic relations between the two countries would be severed, and so as to focus Americans on the grave internal danger that necessitated the curtailment of their constitutional rights, the onslaught would begin en masse against America's 4.5 million Jews. In the wake of von Ribbentrop's Washington visit, and the triumph it represented for the most dangerous of Lindbergh's American supporters, this was Mr. Tirschwell's forecast. And it was so much more pessimistic than anything my father was predicting that he decided not to repeat it to us, or when he got home from the Newsreel Theater for dinner early that evening, to say anything about de Tirschwell's imminent departure, certain that the news would terrify me, rile Sandy, and set my mother clamoring to emigrate at once. Since Lindbergh's inauguration a year and a half earlier, there were estimated to be only 200 to 300 Jewish families who had taken up permanent residence in the Haven of Canada. The Tirschwells were the first such fugitives that my father knew personally, and learning of their decision had left him shaken. And then there was the shock of seeing on film the Nazi von Ribbentrop and his wife warmly greeted on the White House portico by the President and Mrs. Lindbergh, and the shock of seeing all the prominent guests stepping from their limousines and smiling with anticipation at the prospect of dining and dancing in von Ribbentrop's presence, and among the guests, seemingly no less thrilled than the others by the disgusting occasion, Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf and Miss Evelyn Finkel. "I could not believe it," my father said. "The smile on her face is a mile wide. And the husband-to-be? He looks like he thinks the dinner is for him. You should see this man nodding at everyone as if he actually mattered." "But why did you go?" my mother asked him, "when it was bound to upset you like this." "I went," he told her, "because every day I ask myself the same question. How can this be happening in America? How can people like these be in charge of our country? If I didn't see it with my own eyes, I'd think I was having a hallucination." Though we had only just begun dinner, Sandy set down his silverware, mumbled, "But nothing is happening in America. Nothing," and left the table. and not for the first time since the morning my mother had smacked him across the face. At meals now, should the smallest reference be made to the news, Sandy would get up and, without explanation or apology, disappear into our room, pulling the door shut behind him. The first few times, my mother got up after him and went in to talk with him and to invite him back to the table. But Sandy would sit at his desk, sharpening a charcoal pencil or doodling with it on his drawing pad, until she let him be. My brother wouldn't even speak to me when, merely out of loneliness, I dared to ask how much longer he was going to act like this. I began to wonder if he might not pick up and leave home, and not for Aunt Evelyn's, but to live with the Mawinneys on their Kentucky farm. He changed his name to Sandy Mawinney, and we'd never see him again, just as we were never going to see Alvin. And nobody need bother to kidnap him. He'd do it himself. Hand himself over to the Christians so as never again to have anything to do with Jews. Nobody needed to kidnap him because Lindbergh had kidnapped him already, along with everyone else.